Invitation. So, right. So, this talk is about applications of Gower's norms in computer science. Since I imagine, sort of, probably a brief introduction to computer science would be needed, I will start with one. And the first two transparencies, a sort of a general introduction to notions in computer science. And it's very informal, so I would like to ask you to sort of to view it as a book or a movie or something, to suspend your disbelief. So this is just a very brief and probably sort of misleading description of the relevant notions, but just to give you some, you know, background. So NP is a class of mathematical statements with easily verifiable proofs, and with a class of theorems. For instance, you know, a primes contain an arithmetic progression of length 17. Here is a proof. I just produce a progression. Hopefully the primes are sufficiently, the numbers are sufficiently short to be able to write them down, but this is a proof, which could be verified, right? Okay, a very important step to formalize this notion was done by Cook and Levin in 71, who showed that basically a mathematical statement could be reduced, sort of checking the proof, could be reduced to verifying that a given Boolean formula has a satisfying assignment. So any valid statement could be translated efficiently into a satisfiable formula, and we can think about assignment of values to variables in this formula as sort of a proof. This is somewhat misleading, but this is sort of a reasonable way to think about it. And any invalid statement would be translated to an unsatisfiable formula. There is no proof, there is no satisfying assignment. So the next idea is that it would be very neat if we could check a mathematical proof, not by looking at the whole proof, but looking only at some small part of the proof, maybe using randomization, a random part of the proof, but a small one. So, right, so this brings us to the next step. So, as you can see, there are several differences between a computer science talk and a math talk. So first of all, we use colors in our transparencies. And second, we list authors only by the first letters of their names, because usually there are many co-authors, and it's sort of too long. So the first, I'm describing the next step, which is the famous PCP theorem. So the first proof of the PCP theorem was given in four papers with at least eight co-authors with many intersections. So the first letter is Aurora, the last is Mario Segedi, and there are many people in between. And then a short proof of this was given by Reed Dinur in 13 years later. So it turns out that one can do better. One can reduce any valid statement to a satisfiable formula and any invalid statement to a reasonably unsatisfiable formula. So our formulas will be in a specific form. There will be a conjunction, a logical end of terms. So for a formula to be a satisfying assignment should satisfy all the terms. This is an end. It turns out that one can translate any invalid statement to a formula for which any assignment, an optimal assignment, will leave some positive fraction, 1% of the terms unsatisfied. So not only one term will be unsatisfied, but a positive fraction. So here is a way now to test, to check the proof. I'll choose a random term, and we'll sort of ask, is it satisfied by the assignment? Right, so, but this is still not good enough for us. We want to do better, since only like 1% of the terms are unsatisfied. So in the next step, another difficult theorem by Raz in 95, it turns out that we can translate an invalid statement actually into a very unsatisfiable formula. So an optimal assignment leaves 1 minus epsilon fraction of terms unsatisfied for any epsilon, but the size of the formula will depend on epsilon, will grow as epsilon goes to 0. Right, so, and the next step, and many people were involved here, so this is Bellare, Goldreich, Sudan, and Hastad. So it turns out that there is a way to write a proof building on all the previous results of satisfiability, which could be verified by looking at a truly tiny randomized sample from the proof, at 3 bits from the proof, at 3 places. And here is a very rough description of how it is done. So a proof, which we think about as a very long string of bits, is partitioned into strings of length 2 to the n, viewed as functions, from the discrete cube to 0, 1, as Boolean functions. And the way this proof is constructed is such that in a valid proof of a valid statement, all these functions are structured. And in any proof of an invalid statement, many of these functions are not structured. So we should define what structured means, and so on. But this is the idea, and now sort of a verifier would choose a random function, fi, and try to check whether it's structured or not. So here is a building block. Here is this test of the verifier, which was used in PCP constructions. F is a finite field. So given an n-variate function from the field to itself, so any such function could be given by a degree n polynomial in n variables, we want to check whether this function is actually a low degree polynomial in n variables. Low degree means degree d, some parameter which I'll mention later. So either it's a low degree polynomial, in which case we treat it as structured, or it's actually far from all low degree polynomials. Namely, for any low degree polynomial, the probability that this function equals this polynomial, sorry, this function differs from this polynomial when I choose a uniform point in the domain, is at least some epsilon, bounded away from zero. So this means that the function is a bit far from all low degree polynomials, and we sort of interpret this as not structured. So, and we are allowed looking only at a very few places of the function, and at a very few values, and we want to decide with high probability whether the function is a polynomial, or is epsilon far from a low-degree polynomial. This is the main question. This is the type of questions we are going to talk about. Great. And I'll be happy for questions, because probably this is different from, you know, from things people, some people heard, or at least in this conference. Okay. So I'll briefly mention two offshoots of this. First of all, we can generalize this question to checking any combinatorial properties. So this is an area, sub-area of a theoretical CS called property testing. We are given a large combinatorial object. We want to determine whether it has a certain global property, or it's actually somewhat far. We should define distance in an appropriate way, somewhat far from all objects with this property. And we can make only a few queries about this object. So here is a different example, just to show that there are some different examples. We are given a large graph, and we want to determine whether it's bipartite, or we need to remove many edges, at least epsilon fraction of the edges of the full graph, for this graph to become bipartite. And we want to decide this by looking only at a few edges of this graph. So this question was dealt with by Alon and Krivilevich. So just to, you know, to close some circle, one of the main tools in property testing on graphs is Semeredi's regularity lemma. So somehow, you know, things connect. Okay, so to the other extreme, we want to specify even more this testing polynomials with the idea that this might be useful for probabilistic checkable proofs. Suppose in this construction, this long construction I described, this dichotomy is made even stronger. So my structured function is now a low degree polynomial, and my function, the structure is again being a low degree polynomial, and now being unstructured means to be very far from a low degree polynomial. So the question is, can I now distinguish easier between these two cases? So I have two cases. Either the function is a low degree polynomial, or it's basically maximally far from a low degree polynomial. Can this be sort of easily determined by looking only at a few places in the function? So here now we are over the binary field, which we will sort of continue. So this whole talk will be only about F2. And it's easy to see that the maximal distance from low degree polynomials is at most 1/2, because low degree polynomials are closed under complement. So the maximal distance of any function from low degree polynomials is at most 1/2. It's actually slightly less, 1/2 minus O little of 1. But we assume that it's 1/2 minus some epsilon, which is supposed to be very, very small. So can we do this? And in how many queries, how many values of the function we need to know to decide this? So let's start with the easy case of linear polynomials. So I want to distinguish between functions which are linear, or affine to be more precise, and far from all linear functions. So this case is well known. It actually plays an important role in PCP constructions classically. So in the paper of Blum, Lubin, and Rubenfeld in 93, and in the paper of Bellara et al. In 96, they gave a test in which we look at our function only at 3 points, and we return either 0 and 1, or 1. And if the function is linear, we will always return 0. We'll make some computation which always returns 0. And if the function is far from linear, this value will be random. It will get probability 0 or 1. It will get values 0 or 1 with probability about 1/2. So this test makes 3 queries, looks at 3 points of the function, and distinguishes linear functions and functions which are far from linear with probability 1/2. Since if this function is not linear, is far from linear, its probability 1/2 will get 1. And actually, after sort of much more work, Hastad in 97 showed this could be lifted to a PCP construction, PCP based on probabilistically checkable proofs, with the same parameters. Namely, we can verify a proof by looking at 3 random bits of this proof. So there was actually a paper, an article in New York Times, claiming this. Now any mathematical proof could be verified by looking only 3 bits at random. So this was a famous result. Right. So here is a convenient point of view. We want to view linear functions as structured, and functions far from linear as actually pseudo-random. So at least, as I described, we can extract 1 random bit. We can make a computation which behaves randomly on 1 value, either 0 or 1. It turns out that this definition of pseudo-randomness is actually the usual definition. It just means f is far from all linear functions if it has small Fourier coefficients, right? Because the characters are exactly the linear functions. So what do we need to do? We need to distinguish between pseudo-randomness and structure, and do it fast. So the idea of going further with this is we want stronger linearity tests. It turns out that for applications, we want to optimize the ratio between the number of queries we are making to the function and the probability of success of the test, of distinguishing random, sort of pseudo-random from structure. So as you can see, if you go back for a second, if we repeat this basic test, this 3-point test, several times independently, we increase the number of queries linearly and decrease the probability of a failure exponentially, which means actually, I'm sort of saying it vaguely, but this ratio stays the same. So repeating a test independently several times preserves this ratio, and if you want to do better, so a simple test actually gives a ratio of 3, and we want to have a test with the ratio, this row, going to 1 with the number of queries. And this would have many nice applications. In particular, this will imply this theorem of Hastad I mentioned. So, and in fact, one can do this. So in a joint paper with Trevisan, we gave a local test which looks at Q points and returns Q minus square root of 2Q bits. 2q values, q minus square root of 2q values, which behaves deterministically for linear functions, always returns 0, and randomly for pseudo-random functions which are far from linear. So computing this row gives us indeed 1 plus O little of 1 as q goes to infinity. So this is good. I'll describe the test in a second, both the basic test and this test. So, but suppose we want to do even better than this. So this could be lifted to a PCP construction with similar parameters, and now we want to do even better. Could we squeeze out Q random bits out of Q queries? And in fact, so the question leads to this: the following question, how powerful is the notion of pseudo-randomness we are using for the function f? The more, for a totally random function, any bit is random, right? Any bit of the function. So making Q queries, just asking for Q bits of this function, will get Q random bits. So how close our notion of pseudo-randomness, which means small Fourier coefficients, to a truly random function? Right, so before going further, let me describe these tests, which are basically trivial. So the first test, how do we check that the function is linear? So it's very, very simple. We choose 2 points in our domain at random, x and y, and we compute And f of x plus f of y plus of f of x plus y. So we are working over the field with two elements, right? So if the function is linear, then f of x plus y is f of x plus f of y. So this computation returns zero, always. We are over the field with two elements. So on the other hand, it can be proved using simple Fourier analysis that if the function is pseudolinear, has small Fourier coefficients, then this computation actually returns a random bit. Right, so the next step is to use dependent repetitions of this test, which we call graph tests. So we fix the graph on k vertices. Now the test is as follows. We choose k points in our domain at random in the discrete cube. And for all the edges in our graph, we perform this basic linearity test on the points of the domain, which correspond to these vertices. So we compute, for an edge I and j, we compute f of xi plus f of xj plus f of xi plus xj. So again, if the function is linear, we'll get everything is zero. And the question is how the pseudo-random function behaves. So just to... So we know that it should behave randomly. Using Fourier analysis, it's also rather simple. So the number of queries here, as you can see, how many values of the function we check, they correspond to the number of vertices we ask query at all f of xi plus the number of edges of this graph, and the number of bits we get corresponds to the number of edges. So for instance, if we choose g to be the complete graph, we make q queries. Q is the number of vertices plus the number of edges, about k plus k squared over 2, and the number of bits we get is q minus 2 squared q. Great. So, but it's easy to try to do better. Namely, we can look, instead of looking at graphs, we can look at hypergraphs. Right, again, so let us take a Boolean function, and a hypergraph test is exactly the same as a graph test, only we use hypergraphs, right? So we have a hypergraph on k vertices, we choose k points in the discrete cube at random, and for any hyper edge, we compute this computation, we sum our function on all the vertices of the hyper edge and add the value of the function as the linear combination, the sum of the vertices corresponding to points of this hyper edge. Again, a linear function will return zero. And so now our sort of parameters are better because there are many more hyper edges than edges. So if G is a complete hypergraph, we actually make Q queries and return Q minus log Q bits. Log is much better than square root. We are even closer to 1. The only problem is it doesn't work, right? So that's very unfortunate. And there turns out to be a big difference between graphs and hypergraphs, and the bits we get are useless. So, and why is that? Here is a bad example, an inconvenient example we found. So consider the following function, a very simple function. Given a vector x, what it does of even length, it takes the product of its first two coordinates, the first two bits over the field with two elements, adds to it the product of the next two bits, and so on. This is a very simple function. In fact, it's easy to see that in coding sort of terminology, this is a bent function. It's maximally far from all linear functions. Its Fourier coefficients are as small as they could be. On the other hand, any hypergraph linearity test which makes Q queries and accepts linear functions will fail on this function, will accept this function with probability which is not better than the usual graph test. And in fact, after some developments, any test, even not a hypergraph test, any test which looks at Q values of the function, always accepts linear functions, will accept this function also with this probability, which is not better than for a graph test. So, so something is going on here, and, this function must have some hidden structure. So it's sort of pseudo-random with respect to Fourier coefficients, but, it should have some structure. So clearly everybody realizes that the structure is, that this function is a quadratic polynomial, and we also sort of understood this, but sort of the relevance was unclear. Right. So the answer to this question came out of property testing. So let's go back to this. So I'm coming back to this question I mentioned in the beginning. So we have a polynomial, we have a function in n variables over a finite field. We want to determine whether it's a polynomial of low degree or it's far from all, epsilon far from all such polynomials. So the usual situation is the field is large. The field is larger than D. So here is a basic test. The first paper on the subject was due to Babai, Fortnow, and Lund in 91. So we restrict our function to a random line. And then we check if it's a degree D univariate polynomial just by extrapolation. Right? It's a univariate polynomial, it's easy. If the line has more than D points, it's easy to check. D plus 1 points. So this test, of course, always accepts degree D polynomials because an n-variate polynomial of degree D restricted to a line becomes a univariate polynomial of degree D. And it turns out, it demands some proof, but it's not very hard, that if F is far from degree D polynomials, then after some number of iterations depending on epsilon and on the degree, we will find a line in which degree of F is higher than D, and we will detect that it's not a degree polynomial. And actually, this could be described in error-correcting coding terms as a decoding algorithm for generalized read mirror codes. Right. So, in 2003, Alon, Kaufman, Krivilevich, Litzen, and Ron asked what happens if the field is small, say the field is F2. Now the lines are very short. We couldn't do this, but what we could do, we could restrict our function to a random substructure, which is sort of minimal to provide any useful information. So we restrict our function to a random D plus one dimensional affine subspace. And we ask if it's a degree D polynomial. Here it's amount, in this dimension, it amounts to a very simple check. We just sum our function over the affine subspace. If the answer is zero, it's a polynomial of degree D. If the answer is one, it's a polynomial of degree D plus one. Once again, we always accept degree D polynomials, and if it's epsilon far from degree D polynomials, we find, after sufficiently many steps, depending only on epsilon and D, we find an affine subspace on which the function is of degree D plus 1, and we decide that it's not a low degree. Again, this could be interpreted in error-correcting coding terms. Right. So, so looking at this paper of Alon et al., one realizes that what this paper does to test if F is a degree D polynomial, we actually compute a random derivative, a random directional derivative of order D plus 1. So one should, give some interpretation of the notion of derivative, but it's easy, right? So it's just a linear operator which decreases a degree of the polynomial. If you do it D plus 1 times on a degree D polynomial, you get to 0. So if the polynomial is of degree D, we always get 0. And if the derivative is 0 with high probability, very close to 1, then the function is actually close to a low degree polynomial, to a degree D polynomial. This is a way to interpret this, one way. So coming back to our function, and this is, I guess, one of the sort of main observations, coming back to our bad example, it turns out that if we perform hypergraph tests, a hypergraph test with hyperedges of size k, we actually compute k's derivatives. At least one of the bits returned by this test will be a derivative of order k. And actually, many bits compute higher derivatives. And clearly, if our function is a low-degree polynomial, the derivatives will return 0, and this won't be random. So this is the explanation why our tests actually fail. So now we realize that our function is actually pseudo-random with respect to Fourier coefficients, to linear functions. But of course, it's structured for higher degree tests because it's a polynomial of degree 2. So, and the natural question to ask then, maybe this is the only obstacle. So maybe we should just require for our function to be far from all low-degree polynomials, and then we can have better linearity tests. So actually, this gives us two notions of pseudo-randomness. The whole thing, so we want a stronger notion of pseudo-randomness, right? And we have actually two notions for the price of one. The first notion is we just sort of technically, we can require our derivatives of order D to be balanced. To get 0 or 1 is probability basically 1/2. So we define a function to be D pseudo-random if the probability that its random derivative of order D plus 1 is 0 is very close to 1/2, right? Derivatives are or the field with two elements, either derivative is 0 or 1, right? So this gives us some sort of an analytic pseudo-randomness measure for the function. So it's exactly the probability that F restricted to random d plus one dimensional affine subspace is of degree d, minus the probability that it's of degree d plus one, which is always non-negative, and notice this root, 1 over 2 to the d. So this root is necessary to deal with all the other derivatives. So we have many notions of derivative, and in fact one can show that taking this root actually, so this expression is actually larger than the bias of all the derivatives from an appropriate family. Right. So, but it turns out that this, right, yeah, this sort of, yeah. Right, so this, it turns out that this, exactly this notion was defined in the Garros paper on arithmetic progressions for functions on another group. And to write this in an explicit form, so this expression is exactly this 2p over f minus 1. Right, so this is the usual way to write out Gower's norms. Right, and so we call a function pseudo-random if its Gower's uniformity is small. This is a Gower's uniformity of a function. So is this notion helpful? And it is helpful. So in a... Right, so in fact, given that we should distinguish between linear functions and pseudo-random functions with a stronger notion of pseudo-randomness. So either a function is linear or it has lower Gower's uniformity of degree d, then we have a local test, which is exactly a hypergraph test with hyperedges of size d, which looks at q values of a function and now returns much more bits, q minus q to the power 1 over d, which behaves, always returns 0 for linear functions and behaves randomly for pseudo-random functions. And this could actually also be lifted to a PCP construction under some additional assumption, which is called the unique games conjecture. Right, so, but we have another notion which is somehow more intuitive, and this notion is being far from all low-degree polynomials. And this is the right notion we seem to be looking for, right? The only obstacle is being close to a low-degree polynomial, and to have such functions is good. We have additional sort of dividends for computer science purposes. If we have explicit functions like that, which are far from all low-degree polynomials, it would have many interesting consequences. So we have two notions of pseudo-randomness, and can we compare them? So so in the paper of Gowers, and I think more explicitly in the paper of Green et al., they show that one implication is true. So if the function is pseudo-random in one sense, it has low Gower's uniformity, it's far from all polynomials, from all low-degree polynomials. What about the other direction? Right, so we want some sort of an inverse claim. And the main sort of idea is, if our function is not pseudo-random, if its derivative is imbalanced, it should have some structure. So suppose the random derivative of order d of the function is imbalanced. What do we know about it? So if d is 2, for the second derivatives, this is easy, and I described it before. So in this case, function is actually closed to some linear function. This is simply Fourier analysis. This paper of Alon et al. Shows that if this epsilon is actually very close to 1, then the function is indeed close to a degree d minus 1 polynomial. For the case of the third derivative, it could be shown, so it was done independently by Green et al. For finite fields of odd size, odd characteristic, and made by myself for the binary field. In this case, it's indeed true that f is close to a quadratic polynomial. And with in a paper with Trevisan, we showed sort of a different structural result, and sort of not a very hard one, that if f has a non-negligible uniformity, it has a variable with large influence. So this is a combinatorial notion, and in fact this leads to the PCP construction. We need a structural result. Right, so here's a conjecture, an inverse conjecture for Gower's uniformity. Right, so so this conjecture was made by sort of formally by Tao in his talk at Fox, but it also appears sort of as a plausible, sort of not as an official conjecture. I think it appears in their paper from 05, and by myself, that the two notions are equivalent. So the only explanation for the derivative to be skewed, to be imbalanced, that there is some polynomial which is close to the function, non-trivially close to the function. Great. So if this conjecture is true, this would give a nice description of Gauss uniformity, right? Sort of structural description. And it's sort of, you know, morally equivalent to low-degree testing. I mean, how do I test if the function is polynomial? You just compute a random derivative. This is sort of the most natural way to do it. And even weaker conjecture appears slightly later in a paper by Bogdanu and Viola. And what they sort of conjectured is that this equivalence is true at least if f is a function, is a polynomial of degree d plus 1. So, right, so I only want to prove this conjecture for f being f being very close, actually, you know, to low degree. I want to check proximity to degree d, and I can assume that f is of degree d plus 1. So in any case, this sort of led to, gave additional motivation to try and prove this conjecture, but the conjecture is false. And this was proved independently by Green and Tao and Lovett, Meshulam, and myself. And the conjecture is false even for derivatives, for polynomials of degree 4 and derivatives of order 4. Just for the next step. And Green and Tao also have some partial positive results for larger fields, but I guess there are people here who could describe these results better than myself, so I won't. But okay, so here is a counterexample. The counterexample is very simple. It's just the symmetric polynomial of degree 4. So our function is the following, which is just sum over all subsets of size 4, products of variables. In this subset, it turns out that the force uniformity norm of F is huge. It's almost 1. It's greater than 0.9. But on the other hand, F is extremely far from all cubic polynomials. It's 1/2 minus epsilon exponentially small in n. Right? As far as it could go, basically. Right. So, right. So, could one do something with this? Right? Could one recover some sort of a? It seems right. The conjecture is, at least, you know, to us it seems very plausible. So the question is, could we, you know, have some alternative question? So here is a question. So I won't dare to call it a conjecture. So the point is, this derivative we are looking at is the largest possible, and there are other derivatives. Maybe if we assume that actually, you know, many derivatives have this imbalance, not only the largest one, would this imply that f has some non-trivial proximity to a cubic polynomial? And here is some, you know, weak supporting evidence. Bogdanov and Lovett in 08 did find another degree 4 derivative, which is negligible for S4, which is balanced for S4. So, you know, maybe if all of them are imbalanced, we can say slightly more, or maybe there is one derivative which is sort of the smallest in this class as opposed to the largest. We should look at. Right. So I have like 5 minutes, and I won't need them. So the last two transparencies are extremely vague because I thought I wouldn't get to them. So here are some details of the proof. Right. So. So we need to show two things. We need to show that our polynomial has a large Gauss uniformity of degree 4, and that it's far from all cubics. Okay, so computing the directional derivative of this function in four directions, given by four vectors in the cube, y1, y2, y3, and y4, it turns out, and it's not hard to check, that so we need to get one bit, either 0 or 1. So, and because of the, you know, nice combinatorial structure of S4, this bit could be given as follows. We look at a matrix with 4 rows and n columns. So the rows of this matrix are given by the vectors y1, y2, y3, and y4. And what we are doing, we are summing all the 4x4, we are looking at all the 4x4 minors of this matrix, and we are summing the determinants of these minors. This is the answer. This is the computation which gives the derivative. So now, over the field with two elements, it's very lucky that, you know, x equals x squared. So we can write this exactly the same expression, but with determinant squared. And now this, by the Cauchy-Binet formula, is exactly the determinant of a 4x4 matrix, which is the inner products of yi's and yj's. So basically, to compute the force uniformity norm, what we do, we choose four vectors at random, and we compute the determinant of this random 4x4 matrix. And the question is whether it's zero, what's the distribution of the determinant? And, you know, sort of, it's not very hard to analyze. In fact, it's very easy to see that the distribution of this random variable is very close, exponentially close, to the distribution just of a random symmetric matrix. 4x4 symmetric matrix, this matrix is definitely symmetric, this matrix of inner products. And, you know, it's easy to analyze. So this is the computation of the force uniformity norm. So to prove that our function is far from cubics is somewhat harder, but okay, so it's also not very hard. So it turns out, and it's an easy lemma just using Cauchy-Schwarz twice, that the inner product, the correlation between any two Boolean functions, is upper bounded by the average correlation between their derivatives. So actually, the inner product of two Boolean functions is actually the inner product of this plus and minus, of their plus and minus one versions. So instead of f, I'm looking at minus 1 to the power of f. So this is a real number. And so we have this inequality. And if, so why do we want to take derivatives? So let us fix f to be our symmetric polynomial and g be any cubic. So the second derivative of S4 of f is quadratic, and the second, which depends on these directions y and z, in which we take the derivatives. The second derivative of a cubic polynomial is linear, also depending on y and z. And we know by this classical theorem of Dixon, we know exactly what the Fourier spectrum of a quadratic polynomial is. It's basically supported on some linear subspace. So the question is, we want to show that the correlation between f and g is small, that f is very far from g. So we want to show that typically the correlation on the right-hand side between the derivatives is small. The second derivative of g is a character, is a linear function. And we know the Fourier spectrum of f, where the coefficient, the Fourier spectrum is supported. So basically we just want to show that this character gyyz falls with very small probability into this linear subspace, actually of dimension 4. This linear subspace could be of any dimension, of the support of the Fourier spectrum of F. And so, okay, there is some computation to make, and we need some multilinear algebra, but it's not very hard. And anyway, this is, and this proves, this completes the analysis, and this sort of gives this counterexample. Yep, I'm done.